Welcome to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, here's a question, Florida. Should you always have to speak English when you're at your job? Seven workers for the state health department say they were told to stop speaking Spanish at work. The Department of Health says it's investigating this claim. Now, this allegedly happened at a state health clinic in Polk County between Tampa and Orlando. The workers are Puerto Rican, and they say they were speaking in Spanish amongst themselves. One nurse says when she was hired, she was required to be able to speak both English and Spanish because many of the clinic's patients, no surprise, are bilingual.
Now, it is illegal to require workers to speak only English at work, except for what the Department of Labor calls, quote, very limited circumstances. Now, here in Florida, one out of five Floridians speaks Spanish, 20%. Government agencies like school districts, for instance, include Spanish in their official communications. Politicians here in Florida, they run ads in Spanish. This claim in Central Florida is a reminder to all of us that the heat is really high on this melting pot of America.
And that's the question that's shaping our discussion this hour on the Florida Roundup. How race, language, identity are shaping our politics, our very democracy. Here are some questions we want you to think about and call in about. What's your reaction if you hear or speak a language other than English at work or out in public? Does that bother you? Are you okay with that? And how do you think this argument defines the 2020 election, too, and Florida's critical importance? We're spending the hour here on the Florida Roundup exploring the tensions of multicultural Florida and America. It's 305-995-1800. Give us a call right now. And we're already getting your tweets at Florida Roundup. We'll get to those in a moment. But first, let's welcome Adam Serwer. He's staff writer for The Atlantic. His recent essay makes the argument that if America cannot defend multiracial democracy here at home, it can't survive in places around the world either. Adam, so good to have you on the show from San Antonio, Texas, where you live. I want to begin by asking you, what are your thoughts about the claims by these healthcare workers here in Florida? How do you see that story relating to the themes you write about when it comes to race and identity here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I think America is a big, diverse country with a lot of different types of people, and it's really not unusual for employees in particularly in cities to speak different languages. In fact, it's typically thought of as an asset because, you know, if you have a diverse customer base, you're going to want workers who can communicate with those customers. But we have a president who regards people of Latin American descent as a kind of threat to the country. And so it's not surprising that that sentiment if that sentiment didn't exist in the country in the first place, he wouldn't have been elected. And it's not surprising that people feel more comfortable expressing it now towards the people of Latin American descent in their life.
And so in The Atlantic, as you have written over the last few weeks, drilling down into this theme, you've argued that the president's appeal and his campaign is centered around the idea that, as you say, that only white people are true Americans. Are we at a hinge point in America in terms of how we define a multiracial democracy? Why do you feel so much is at stake?
Well, I'll say that it's not just me that's making that point. The president made it very clear, and his advisors have told any reporters who have asked that the president himself believes that singling out those four Democratic congresswomen who are Black, Arab American, and Hispanic, that focusing on them is a great way to enrage his base and divide the country along racial lines, which is key to his reelection strategy. So it's not merely a question of what I think. It's actually what the president thinks. It's the strategy he's pursuing. It's the one his advisors have said he's pursuing. And I do think it is a hinge point for American democracy because, you know, this battle about over whether or not we are fundamentally a white Christian country or a place where anybody can come and become an American is an argument that is existential. It predates the founding in some way. It is certainly a part of the founding. And it's not surprising that we're still grappling with it today, given the history of how those conflicts have gone. I mean, when you look at the Civil War, you look at Jim Crow, you look at right? The battle over immigration restriction in the early 1920s, where Asian people, Africans, Jews, and Italians were barred from coming to the country. I mean, this is something that we've been dealing with for a long time, and this is really just the latest iteration of that conflict.
Adam, it's Tom Hudson. Reflect a little bit more on that history, right? Because racial tension is at the core and the founding of the United States, where we've seen that, for instance, with the 500th anniversary of the slave trade here in 2019. So kind of compare and contrast what you are writing about and observing with this tension and the questions you're asking about multiracial democracy and how that compares even in modern history over the last 100 years, for instance, with the tension that was exhibited not only in society, but certainly reflected in our politics.
Well, I think even if you go back to the founding, you had black writers who before the war with Britain was over, they were mocking the white colonists for saying that Britain was enslaving them because some of them owned literal slaves. So the idea that this argument is something recent, invented by oversensitive liberals is really just not true. It's something that we've been dealing with for a very long time. When you go back to the immigration restriction laws of the 1920s, that was a time when the country had a high percentage of people who were foreign-born. Many of them were from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. Mm-hmm. And those immigrants, primarily Italians, Jews, Slavs, were considered by the sort of old stock elite Protestants in the United States to be of inferior genetic stock, and mm-hmm. they passed these immigration restriction laws, in fact, to preserve what they believed was America's original genetic heritage. Now, those laws also had a big influence on the development of Nazi Germany. Obviously, anti-Semitism in Europe is very old, but it's significant that this is a part of our history that, reared itself, reared its head 100 years ago and has returned again for us to deal with now.
Adam, I'll correct myself, 400th anniversary of the slave trade. I believe I said 500th. I apologize for that. But what's the tenor that's changed in your studying of history and your estimation, reflection on today's rhetoric and the language that's being used and the actions that you're seeing?
I think that the tenor that's changed is that I don't want to say that having someone like Trump in office is entirely unprecedented. As we saw, a couple of weeks ago, The Atlantic published a tape of a conversation between Nixon and Reagan mm-hmm. in which Reagan referred to the African delegates at the UN as monkeys who weren't even comfortable wearing shoes yet. So this idea that people of color are sort of unfit for self-government is something that has a long history in the United States. I think what's different is that on the surface, people like Nixon and Reagan, traditionally, presidents from both parties, even when they have quietly subscribed to racist ideas, publicly they have emphasized America's multicultural heritage and its status as a place where anybody from anywhere in the world can come and be successful and happy. What's different is that the president today it engages in a level of racial demagoguery towards his opponents that I think is more or less unprecedented in terms of using his bully pulpit in that way.
And let me ask you as a follow-up, Adam, as you write in The Atlantic, true multiracial democracy in this country where most Americans more or less have a fair shake and equality has really only been around since the civil rights movement, so about 50 years or so. You argue that unless the president is defeated next year, this fragile project, as you call it, will fail, not only in America, but you think this endangers the very concept of liberal democracy around the world. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I think I can't remember whether I said the president himself or Trumpism, which I think is the larger issue here. These issues are not going to go away if Trump gets defeated next year. This sort of sense that demographic change is somehow threatening the status of white Americans is a staple of programming on Fox News. It's something that exists within the president's base, and it's something that is not going to go away when he's gone. But I do think when you look at the military and political influence of the United States internationally, and the way that right-wing ethno-nationalists have been rising, you know, across the world on the basis of similar ideas, I think it's, you know, I am not optimistic that if America rejects this idea of liberal multiracial democracy, that other countries are not going to have similar problems.
Bringing it back down to the level, Tom, of what Adam is saying is, if people don't feel comfortable speaking Spanish in public, at their job, that's the local issue we're looking at, and then writ large, what does that mean? What does that mean globally?
Lots of folks want to share their experiences with language at work. 305-995-1800 is the phone number all across the state of Florida, at Florida Roundup on Twitter as well. Your thoughts about how multiracial issues and how this debate is ringing through, not only in your neighborhood, your community, but yeah, there's political influences here. There's no doubt about it, because a lot's at stake in 2020 for all of the United States, regardless of what side of the political aisle you may find yourself on. Let's begin on line two, Rebecca in Tallahassee. Go ahead. You're on the radio, Rebecca. Your thoughts.
I honestly think it's absurd, the idea that people would be offended by overhearing conversations in other languages in this country. Most of our states don't bear English names, even from Native American, Mississippi, Utah, you know, Dakota,
Florida,
French for Louisiana and Vermont, you know, yeah, Spanish, Montana, so on and so forth. And I think it's really just an insecurity of not possessing that skill to be bilingual when most of the world is. And when Americans travel to other nations that aren't a first English, you know, speaking country, we almost expect them to speak English to us, even if it's not their first language. And it's just, for a country with no official language, I just find it completely absurd for someone to be offended. And I think it's really down to the insecurity of a person who's honestly eavesdropping.
Yeah.
Which is kind of rude to begin with.
Rebecca, thanks for sharing your thoughts there. Adam, I'm curious as to your thoughts on this kind of role of insecurity and maybe American insularism, so to speak, in regards to English as the language, but also the culture of Americanism.
Well, so I'll say two things. One is that part of the problem here is the representation of people of color as somehow a locked-in voting bloc for Democrats, and therefore the more diverse the country gets, the more that Democrats are going to be able to dominate the country. And I think that's fundamentally false. Mm-hmm. I also think it's kind of racist to assume that people's political views are going to be consistent simply because of their biological inheritance.
Yeah. We've seen that on display here in Florida, Adam. Right. We saw it in 2016. We've seen it in 2018, as a matter of fact, in the state elections.
Right. And I think, you know, it is particularly weird to be in Florida and be shocked by the presence of people who are speaking different languages. I mean, I was in Miami 2 weeks ago and I walked into a Winn-Dixie, which had the largest kosher section in any supermarket I'd ever seen in the United States. And in about 10 minutes, I heard people speaking Haitian Creole. I heard people speaking Spanish and I heard people speaking Hebrew. And that's America. That's just the way we are.
It is a wonderful thing, Adam.
I'm
so glad you pointed that out, because that's why we decided to focus the full hour on this. We are on the air statewide, and there's so much diversity culturally in this state. Central Florida is very different from South Florida. The panhandle is completely different from where you were describing in Miami. And so it's particularly fascinating, I think, to talk about this through the Florida lens, because as you just said, yes, we're incredibly diverse, but there's so much variety in Florida. It's almost like a series of states. It's almost like several states rolled into one, if you take my meaning there. And so let's go to some callers on this for Adam Serwer of The Atlantic. Richard is in Jacksonville. Richard, hey, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. I've been really researching lately W.E.B. Du Bois and his concept of a double consciousness as it relates to how black people feel when they look at themselves as black and then at the same time look at themselves as how white people look at them. I just asked a white friend of mine today, have you ever walked into a room and given thought to whether everybody is looking at you as differently? And he said in his entire life that has never happened. I said that happens to me on a daily basis. Because I'm conscious.
Oh, we lost his
Richard,
call,
I think they lost the call there.
But Adam, you know, he's describing what a different experience it is for a Black American, a person of color, than it is a white person. That sort of invisible backpack white folks have, the whole concept of privilege, right?
Well, so I actually hate the term white privilege, and I never use it because
why
I think
do you hate it?
Always. I think that there's almost always, I think it's vague. I think it's fine in an academic context as a shorthand to refer to various effects of discrimination. But I think you can almost always get specific. Are you talking about the fact that police are more likely to use lethal force against Black people or stop them in their cars? Are you talking about the fact that people with quote-unquote Black-sounding names are less likely to get callbacks for jobs? Are you talking about the fact that, a local ICE agency actually detained a whole bunch of people on the basis without actually having any information about their citizenship because the people were of Hispanic descent? I mean, you can almost always be extremely specific about the way in which racial discrimination is manifesting without using the term white privilege, which for me, mm-hmm. I think, tends to obscure more than explain. In this case, the caller was referring to an experience that Black people who go into professional environments or live in mostly white areas have, which is you walk into the room and you're the only Black person there. And, you know, sometimes white people do have that experience, if you are not used to having that experience and you are used to being in the majority, it can make you extremely uncomfortable, and you can have a reaction to that if you don't interrogate can lead you to believing or falling into believing stereotypes that are not in fact true.
And how are people encountering that in your experience, Adam? And how are they kind of processing that? I mean, even as the caller spoke about his relationship with a white friend and how there just wasn't a basis for that same kind of reflection.
Well, I mean, I think it's a very common experience. If you are a Black professional, if you've ever been the only Black person in a high school class or a college class or even in a meeting room, and someone expects you to represent or speak for all Black people, it's just a common experience. And I think that, what Du Bois was talking about was not just this idea of this idea of looking at yourself from outside of yourself, mm-hmm. but sort of being aware of how other people perceive you on the basis of what they have heard, but don't actually know because they don't know anyone like you.
Mm. We have so many tweets coming into the Florida Roundup. So many. Here's one. I don't agree with the way you're framing this discussion. It's lumping anyone who feels uncomfortable when a foreign language is being spoken as a racist. Another man writes, my wife's Puerto Rican. I'm white. She's had comments made at her when she's been out and about. I'm worried about someone accosting her with our son. We will go back to some more calls and tweets after this break as we continue our conversation with Adam Serwer of The Atlantic. We're discussing Florida and America in the context of our multiracial democracy. How do you see this issue? What are your thoughts and reactions? The number to join us is 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. Keep them coming. We'll get to some more of those in just a moment. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday as we continue our discussion about race, identity, language, our multiracial democracy. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. You can join the conversation at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800 on the phone, or we're on Twitter as well, @FloridaRoundup. Adam Serwer is along with us, staff writer for The Atlantic. Adam, I want to go back to a tweet that Melissa mentioned before our break from a listener saying that they didn't agree with the way we're framing this discussion on language. The tweet continues, it's lumping anyone who feels uncomfortable in unfamiliar social situations where a foreign language is being spoken as a Trump supporter and a racist. It's a very unnuanced way to hear this conversation, I suppose. But when somebody hears the conversation that we've been having that way, what's your takeaway, Adam?
I mean, look, I think it's not actually particularly unusual for someone in a new or unfamiliar social situation to feel uncomfortable. But I do think it's different to focus on someone else speaking another language as the source of the discomfort. I mean, look, you know, I didn't understand anything I heard in that grocery store, but I certainly wasn't, you know, afraid or uncomfortable. It was just I'm in Miami. That's just how it is.
But it's striking to me, and we saw in this one particular tweet, but I think it is emblematic of conversations
how you
that we've
react
all
to that.
Had.
Like, if you feel comfortable in a setting like you described, Adam, where there's a whole range of languages being spoken in a public place, or even one other one. Whether or not you feel that that's a net positive for America or a net negative, I think is driving so much of our current political discussion and debate over not just immigration, but just the changing character of America, the changing demographics of America.
Right. Well, I think that, I think that the history of the United States is one in which, we haven't waves of immigration. We have new immigrants. Those immigrants seem different and foreign and alien, and they're speaking a funny language, and they're all living together. And what we've seen over and over again is that the panic over those immigrants is always completely unfounded. The, you know, people assimilate by the third generation. Mm-hmm. Most Hispanic, third generation Hispanic immigrants don't actually even speak Spanish anymore. I think that there's a faithlessness both in this country and its civic culture and its ability to absorb people of different backgrounds. But I also think that it's just a historically short-sighted argument to believe that somehow the country is going to be destroyed by the influx of people who are different. It's the argument that was made about the ancestors of the people who are making that argument now. And for some reason, we have never really absorbed the lesson.
This century, Florida is on the edge of that. From 2010 to 2018, the Florida population grew by 2.2 million people. 48% of those came from overseas. So only 52% of the population growth came from the 49 other states. The rest of Florida's population growth, which is what Florida has been based on and the economic growth that Floridians have been able to enjoy this past decade, to a large extent has been fueled by international migration of folks moving to Florida and becoming Floridians, Adam.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, there's the evidence is pretty clear that immigrants are a net economic benefit for people in the country. I think that doesn't, you know, if you tell someone that and they have concerns about immigration, that's obviously not going to convince them. But I think there's truth and there's falsehood, and there's facts and there's things that are not facts. And the facts are that when you look at history, these panics about immigration that
they're
sometimes
not new
lead to restrictions, they're not new, and they never end up being correct.
Let's
it's certainly the case that the country changes. I'm not going to say that immigrants don't change the country at all, but the idea that America stops being America because of the presence of these people is simply false.
And that gets into what we've kind of been getting at throughout the hour, embracing America as an idea. Or embracing the kind of white ethno-nationalism, blood and soil nationalism, that has raised so many alarms here in this country and around the world. Let's get to some tweets from listeners. If I'm ever confronted by someone telling everyone that the demand is to speak English, I'll ask them, where in the First Amendment does it state freedom of speech is only allowed in the English language? Here's another one. If you're uncomfortable about hearing a different language, then you are a racist. And if you don't like the word racist, then maybe you need to address why you're acting like a racist. One more tweet. Guys, as a native Miamian, I've seen the language change. And I know friends who've left Miami because of the changes they're hearing around them in the language. And that gets into the idea, Adam, that people are really sorting themselves across the country into political neighborhoods, into places in America where they feel more comfortable. That's one example of that. Say you're someone who lived in Miami for many years and you moved away because you started to feel uncomfortable about hearing Spanish spoken everywhere you went. I mean, these are real demographic changes Florida and other states have experienced. And I know you've written about that as well, right?
I mean, look, if people, I mean, it's certainly people are within their rights to react that way to population changes around them. But I think it's actually quite difficult to look at someone who is different from you and say, this person is different from me. I don't want to be around this person, and say that that has nothing to do with prejudice.
Mm-hmm. Some more phone calls, 305-995-1800 in Miami. JR on line 12 has been patient. JR, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Adam, I'm a Miamian, and can relate to going into a grocery store, as you said, and the different types of languages that you hear, and culture as well. I own an automotive shop, and in my business, there is a law that's trilingual, English, Spanish, and Creole. The county accepts that and understands that. But we have to also look at something here. There's a difference between knowing how to speak English and Spanish, and as an employer, if I hire someone that doesn't speak English, there's an issue, because obviously there are mechanical or diagnostic things that they cannot do. So there is a position as an employer where, to me, that person needs to speak English, and Spanish is a plus, not necessarily, but there is more of a benefit in that end. And I'll leave the comments up to you all.
So, JR, it's Tom. I mean, you know, you're right about an employer, and, you know, anybody who's looked at want ads online sees, you know, necessary skills and preferred skills. And certainly here in South Florida, employers are not shy about putting a necessary skill as Spanish or a preferred skill as Spanish and oftentimes Creole or even Portuguese or other languages.
Right. And is that really considered racist? Because I need someone that can communicate with my customer base. Doesn't mean that I, you know, want to discriminate from one or the other. But if I'm in an area like Miami where it's so multicultural, mm-hmm. I mean, even in the Spanish language, there are different levels and different countries that have different meanings in each word. And it's not as simple as just speaking English or Spanish. It's communicating. And if we're to communicate in this world, and we'll communicate with other people, we need to learn and accept that not everybody's the same, that we all have and come from different cultures, but we can coincide with each other and work together, which is obviously the purpose of it.
JR, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. Adam Sorwer with The Atlantic. Is this tension coming together in the 2020 election? Is this the hot point in this situation, in this conversation, to put it mildly?
Well, I think that the president certainly thinks it is. I think that he has built his reelection strategy around a kind of racial and cultural resentment of people who are different, and that's the reason why he is centered the four congresswomen, the so-called squad, in his daily political mm-hmm. flayings of his enemies. But I think that we're in a little bit of a different place now than we have been before. I think that arguably the country today, or rather a majority of the country, is actually more welcoming to people who are different mm-hmm. than it's ever been in American history. And that's sort of hard to see because of the politics that we have at the moment. But, you know, at the end of the Civil War, during the Civil Rights Movement, a majority of white Americans didn't think that there was anything unfair about Jim Crow. And I think if you look at the American electorate now, it's much more progressive on issues of diversity than mm-hmm. it's ever been in American history. Is that going to be enough for whatever Democrat runs against Donald Trump? It might not be. But I do think that, there's a lot of reason for optimism that Americans can appreciate and understand and accept each other's differences without you know, becoming violently disagreeable mm-hmm. with each other.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Adam Serwer, staff writer at The Atlantic, for the full hour this Friday on the Florida Roundup. We began the hour looking at a case of some Puerto Rican healthcare workers who claim they were illegally ordered here in Florida to only speak English at work. And this has turned into a fascinating discussion involving callers and listeners from all over the state. Here's a tweet from Brian, by the way. He says, "We have amnesia. German Americans use their language to help get Hessian mercenaries to desert from the British. America was never English only," he says. It's 305-995-1800. Mike is in Miami. Hi, Mike. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
I had just called in because Mr. Hudson said something at the outset of the show that what happened, well, when you tell somebody to speak only English at work, that's illegal, and I didn't think that, that was quite correct. We had the issue come up at my work. I work in a Miami law firm. I had to do a little bit of research on it just to see for myself because I wasn't quite sure where the law was, and I concluded based upon finding both federal and Florida judicial decisions that when it's necessary for the operation of the business, mm-hmm. you can, in fact, require your workers to speak English only in their conversations and whatnot. Now, personal time at work, lunch hour, that's different. But if they're on the phone or talking to each other, under those circumstances, you can require it.
Mike, it's Tom. Right. The Department of Labor says there are, quote, very limited circumstances in which employers can require English at work in the professional capacity, not on the lunch break or something like that.
No. That's correct. And I just I wanted to make sure that that was clear because although you know this is the first time hearing about what happened in Central Florida, you know, it really brought a caused a lot of problems at my work.
Interesting. Thanks for that perspective. Yeah. You know, we're getting tweets, too, Adam, from listeners to this discussion saying that they have sometimes had anxiety. I'm paraphrasing here. But that they feel that sometimes people shift to speaking in another language than English when they want to talk about someone behind their back or joke about something that they don't want the only English-speaking person to hear. There have been several comments like that that have come into the show over this hour, this almost anxiety that people feel that aren't bilingual, that they're being left out of the discussion somehow.
I mean, maybe. I mean, I'm sure that happens, but have you never, like, pulled out your phone to text a friend about someone who, you know, bumped you in line as you were trying to get on the bus or something like that? It's
right.
not, I mean, I guess, you know, in the range of things that bother me, the possibility that someone is, you know, saying that my shoes are ugly in Spanish behind me while I'm waiting in line.
Right.
Not,
I mean, you didn't,
know,
you don't
want
that.
It's not tremendously high on my list.
You're not that concerned.
Of things that bother me.
But what's fascinating about this current discussion is there are millions of Americans for whom that it's very upsetting. They're angry about having to press one for English and two for Spanish, for example, when they call a doctor's office or whatever it is, you know.
I mean, I've heard that. I mean, that argument goes back to like the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of I mean, I'm not even sure if companies even do that anymore, but in the way that it's usually phrased, but it simply. I don't know. I honestly don't know what to say. As someone who grew up, you know, in Washington, D.C., when I went to play soccer, I was the only non-El Salvadoran kid on the team. Mm-hmm. It's just not something that I personally find tremendously threatening. And I think that if people do find it threatening, it's worth asking what bothers them about it. And, you know, just because something makes you personally uncomfortable, that's not necessarily a reason to use the force of the state to make you feel more comfortable.
I just wanted to share with you, kind of stretching this beyond just language or beyond only language, into just other world affairs. The station here in Miami where I'm at, we received a text from a listener this morning that read, "Another Iran morning, really. Keep Steve Inskeep, Morning Edition host, at home focusing on American problems. We don't care about Iran. Review the history books." This from an NPR listener in South Florida. Beyond language, but talking about a rejection of international news in this case.
Well, I think that's very strange. But, you know, if you don't like the news program that you're listening to, you can always change it.
You can always change
it. I hope they don't change it.
I think, sure. In a sense, I mean, there's a way in which, you know, there is a sensitivity to the very presence of people who are different from you that I think the people who have that sort of hostile reaction, you know, for them to try and use the state to impose their preferences on other people simply because they're different is unfair.
Yeah, that gets to the heart of why we felt the need to build the hour around this incident. These state government workers here in Florida who allege that their supervisor told them, you have to speak English and only English at work. Here are some more tweets for everybody. Here's one from Hal. "Americans are the only people who aren't bilingual. When I moved from Boston to the Panhandle," he says, "it was like moving to a third world country." Black Fluent tweets the show, "Language barriers work both ways. There's video of a woman being refused service at a Taco Bell drive-thru in Miami because she didn't speak Spanish."
Yeah.
Okay, so that gives you an idea of the complexity of this here in Florida, Tom and Adam. It's really interesting to get the reactions from coming in from different parts of the state, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And, you know, with Florida, again, kind of on the edge of this change. I mean, we're seeing this change here. The majority of Floridians under the age of 70 are people of color. White non-Hispanic Floridians younger than 70 years old make up just over 49% of the population. It is just the numbers here show that it's a minority. And in fact, people of color, 56% of Florida's population from 0 to 44 years old. More conversation still to come on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we continue our discussion with Adam Serwer, staff writer at The Atlantic, and your calls from across the state, an hour-long discussion on the intersection of identity, race, our multi-ethnic, multiracial democracy, and what that is doing as it drives our politics. It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. So many tweets coming into the show. Here's one from Cesar. 41 million people speak Spanish at home. It's the most studied language in the U.S. Spanish has been present in what is now the U.S. since the 15th century. He says Anglo-cultural anxiety is ignorant and dangerous, and it needs to be denounced. Let's go to Karen in St. Pete. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, great. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is an interesting topic. I think that I do have one little comment to make, is that I love hearing other languages and I love hearing different accents. In fact, I crave them. I'm in St. Petersburg, don't really get to hear them very often. But on the other hand, when I do wonder what the circumstances were for these people to have been told not to speak another language and, you know, at work. Were they speaking another language in front of another person who didn't understand them? You know, if you're a healthcare professional, you want that you want the patient to be able to understand what you're saying, and you want to be able to seem you want to make that person comfortable. And on top of that, going back to any kind of service job, whether it's customer service or anything, the person who is being interacted with, they should feel comfortable with, whether they're Hispanic or Latino or any other country,
and you know, Karen,
everyone should feel comfortable.
And I hear you. We are still learning about the case. what the nurses mm-hmm. allege is that they were only speaking amongst themselves in Spanish, and that they would speak English to an English-speaking patient, Spanish to a Spanish-speaking patient. We still need to learn more about it, but that's what they're saying,
right.
Which is why they've brought the complaint. And so the question, as Tom pointed out earlier, is employers cannot legally force someone to only speak English at work unless there are special
right.
circumstances. That's, I think, gets to the heart of it. And I appreciate
right.
your
but,
thoughts.
But the question still for me remains, what were the circumstances? Because if they were, let's say that if I'm working on a patient and my coworker is standing there beside me and she says, hey, in Spanish, hey, can you tell me, you know, how to get to the grocery store? And I speak back to her in Spanish, that there's nothing wrong with what I said, but it still makes that person who's sitting there who only knows English wondering what they're talking about. Yes, mm-hmm. You could say that person's paranoid, and that could be a very unique situation, but there's other situations where if someone's having an entire conversation in front of this other person, and I think that might be, that's where I wonder where this employer is going when they said, don't speak Spanish. I agree. We all should be, you know, we should be thrilled that there are people who speak other language and bring in their cultures. But there's also a risk before we even jump on a bandwagon and go, hey, whoever said that was a racist person. We don't really know. I personally haven't heard yet the situation why these two nurses were singled out as saying, don't speak Spanish at work.
Okay. Thanks, Karen. That's Karen in St. Pete. Gratifying to get calls from all over the state on this. Adam Serwer, your thoughts about what her perspective on this?
Well, look, I could certainly understand feeling like it's a bit rude to have if you're talking to someone and they then turn around and have a conversation in another language with someone else. It's a little bit like if you are talking to someone and then you go and you whisper about them to someone else who's right next to you. And I think it does depend on the actual circumstances. If they're simply reacting to someone, you know, speaking Spanish at work, I think that's different than if they're doing it. I mean, obviously the context always matters. It's not unreasonable
yeah.
To expect people to speak the same language as the person that they're, you know, the patient or the customer while they're serving them. I don't think that's unreasonable. But, you know, if the mere presence of Spanish in the workplace is what's offensive, I do think that's completely unreasonable. You know, I've worked in newsrooms where other my fellow reporters have had conversations in Spanish with each other. It does not bother me. I think that's very different from, you know, a situation in which someone is not fulfilling their work obligations in some way.
Line five here. Jared in Miami has been patient. Jared, your thoughts on this. Go ahead.
Well, fascinating topic. I have two experiences that are very close to that. One is was teaching in a college that was actually a nursing school. And the faculty, all of the faculty were Hispanic, and the students were mixed. So there were students half in the classes that, you know, not half, but a handful that did not speak Spanish. And the issue that kept coming up was that the faculty members were speaking and teaching in Spanish all the time, hmm. or most of the time, and you have students who are there who don't, you know, understand Spanish, and obviously they're paying for this college, and it became a really big deal and a crisis that really couldn't be kind of taken care of, and a lot of students kind of left the school because of that. Which is kind of related to then, you know, if you're going into work in the hospital and you're learning, you know, you're supposed to, and you're learning in Spanish and not really studying in English, and then you go in, you know, we're training nurses to go in to the hospitals and they're not they can't speak English
yeah.
or at least, you know,
yeah.
work in English. It's a pretty serious, you know, it created a crisis. Now,
sure, you're going to have a healthcare crisis there. Jared, I appreciate it. I'd like to get, Adam, kind of your thoughts on this intersection between assimilation and language. And Jared's experience there with healthcare shows, you know, the stakes can be very high when it comes to the inability to communicate clearly and quickly in a healthcare emergency, for instance, when you have two languages where neither party is able to understand the other.
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable to think that to say that in certain professions, a particular language proficiency is a requirement. I don't think that's unreasonable at all. I mean, but I think that that's actually distinct from saying, from barring the use of other languages in a workplace. I think those are two completely different
understood.
Issues.
So, but explore a little bit, kind of the assimilation trajectory, reality, and some would say argument, and how language intersects that. Certainly, in a place like South Florida and Central Florida, where there's a large population of Spanish speakers.
Well, when you look at the history, I mean, you know, when Italians and Jews first came to the United States in large numbers, people were saying that, you know, these Italians aren't learning English, or, you know, these Jews are clustering in neighborhoods where they only speak Yiddish. And you can see the old side, there are all those very famous photographs of the old Lower East Side with signs in Yiddish everywhere.
There's some on Beach, on Miami Beach, for instance.
Yeah. But of course, that was not actually the barrier to assimilation that those people claimed at the time that it was. And when you look at statistically, Latino immigrants, by the third generation, the children don't even really speak Spanish fluently anymore.
That's interesting to note. And let me just jump in and say one real quickly. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Okay, Adam Serwer with The Atlantic, who's been with us in such an insightful way for the full hour. Let's bring it all back to the beginning, which is that we launched into this discussion based on the local case in Florida and have so appreciated your insights looking at this issue globally. Your final thoughts about how this issue of immigration and multiculturalism will drive the 2020 election, as we here in Florida, of course, as a swing state, are focused on that very closely as well.
Well, look, I think that, you know, I can't tell you exactly what the big issues in the election are going to be, but I can tell you that the president very firmly believes that this is going to be an election that centers around questions of racial identity and, by extension, existential questions about the nature of American democracy. And I think that, you know, whatever happens in 2020, those questions aren't going to go away because they've been with us for centuries. It's an argument, essentially, that every generation has in a way.
Right. Nothing new. But as you've been writing about and as we've been discussing, it's become particularly contentious in this country, and we are living through it right now. How do you see?
I think that's right. We're going to have to decide what kind of country we want to be, and I think that question is very clear both to the president and to the people who are opposing him.
You come down on the side of we must defend a multiracial democracy.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I don't think
I mean,
that
you've
I think
that,
that is
that
the essence of the American idea. Even I think it's the essence of the American idea, even when we haven't lived up to it. And I think that, we have tried doing it different ways, and it does not work. I mean, the ideology of white nationalism has killed more Americans than any other idea in American history. It does not work. The only thing that works is living up to American ideals, or at least striving for those ideals. And that ideal is that anybody can be an American, that no one is more American than anybody else, and that simply being born white or being born Christian does not make you more American than someone who came here from Haiti or Italy or Russia or anywhere else.
Adam Serwer of The Atlantic, thank you for your thoughts this full hour. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville, WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director this hour. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz. We get engineering help each week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Quorum. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday at noon.